Welcome to the Heavenly Banquet, where the hungry are filled with good things. I'm Charlotte.
I'm Chad.
Chad, you know, some friends of mine often will comment on the podcast and wonder why we don't have a format like other podcasts that they listen to, where the two hosts like banter about their personal lives for a couple of minutes before they get into the topic.
Oh.
And what they don't understand is that we don't talk about that kind of stuff even with each other. And we certainly wouldn't do it with the public. I hesitate to ask how you are sometimes because I don't want to pry, you know? But today we are going to get personal a little bit, at least with me, and kind of kick things off by talking about something that I've been experiencing, because we almost immediately, when I shared with you what I was dealing with, you got to the philosophical, which actually made it far more interesting and less cumbersome what was happening. But anyway, I'll just get right to the end of it first and then how I found out. But I'm experiencing what actually many people are experiencing as a long COVID symptom, which is we know a lot of people lost their sense of taste or smell. And then some of the other ones of us gained like phantom smell abilities. And so what that means is that for me, I will often smell cigarette smoke and smell it really strongly. And it does not exist. But the smell is so real to me that I feel like I can't catch my breath. I feel like I'm in like the smokiest room ever. And I mean, it'll make my eyes like tear up. I mean, I just feel like I'm in that space, like beyond the actual smoke sensation.
Yeah.
And this started maybe 6 months ago. And when it started, I thought, oh, it's the heat system. We have an old oil heater at home. And I was like, oh, it's, you know, there's some dust or something. I don't know. Or people are building fires outside. I, you know, why wouldn't I smell smoke right now? Right. Except other people weren't. But then I also attributed that to, well, I've always had a very keen sense of smell. So here we are. But then I started smelling that smoke in places where it definitely like couldn't have been.
Yeah.
So in the car, in the office, just like outside, when all kinds of places. And eventually, and before I finally Googled it, because I didn't think there was anything wrong. That's why I wasn't Googling it. I was just like, I smell smoke. When I started to realize, you know, people around me weren't smelling it, there was a point where I thought, oh no, I've gained mystical abilities. And I thought, I can actually smell the evilness around me. This is terrible. Because what I wasn't realizing, which I realized later, is that it's also really heightened, or my experience of it, when I'm stressed. So you guys, it's not all the time. I could go like a day or two without it, and then I'll have a day where it's like, this is a very smoky day, right?
Wow.
But at that time, like, it was certain people would kind of trigger it, who were stressors at work, things like that, or even getting an email from that person. I would see that flash up and I would be like, up smoke. And then I was like, oh, that must be because they were sent from hell to torment me. Especially, you guys, I didn't think that for a couple of days. And it worried me, actually. But then I Googled it and it was like, no, this is a really common long COVID thing, which has also showed me some different ways to kind of manage it. But it's obviously low on the list of things that people are experiencing as a long COVID or post-COVID symptom. It's getting me to check in a lot more with kind of like when I start to smell smoke, with stopping and going, oh, wait, why are we stressed right now? Like, what's going on?
Yeah.
But otherwise, what it has brought up for me is like, it is so real. It is so real for me. And it's so particular. It's not just smoke, it's cigarette smoke. It is like being at the Moose Lodge or something, just absolutely clouded with it. Like I said, I have other kind of physical experiences of it, like my eyes burning and my throat itching, because it is so real.
Yeah.
But it starts to take over psychosomatically everywhere else. And for me to think, I know not to like fully trust my senses. or my experiences, but how could it be so wildly different and not at all real? But I'm feeling it, experiencing it in a way that is so incredibly real to me. And just getting back to some things that are at the heart of philosophy and therefore at the heart of theology as well, around how do we know what we know? How do we experience phenomenon in this world? Whether or not we share those actual experiences. I used to think before when I did beer education, you know, we would taste something and all talk about what we were tasting. I was like, okay, there's a lot of similar notes here, but are we really experiencing the same thing, you know, or not? You know, and even if we're using common terms, are the references that we're using something that we experience similarly? So there, that's where that's where I am in a little philosophical crisis.
Yeah.
But not, but we always are.
Right. Well, I'm sorry you're experiencing that. That's got to be a little bit discontenting to know that you're experiencing something that's not actual. And you know, I've talked about this some, and of course it brings to mind kind of the old, how do we know we're each experiencing the same color? You know, red is the red I experience the same as the red that you experience. In early modern philosophy, this, I think this issue kind of came to the forefront for a long time. And I think this would be true for folks like Aristotle and Aquinas. They believed in what's referred to as direct realism, which is in the philosophy of perception. It's this idea that we perceive the world as it is, that there's no real difference between what I'm seeing and the way the world is when it's not being seen. So I'm looking out my window now, and there's a green bush outside the window. If I'm not looking, if nobody's looking at it, it's still a green bush, still looks the same, same color, and so on.
So the if the tree falls in a forest and no one's observing it?
Well, it was because of this idea of direct realism that Berkeley kind of came up with a little bit later. Sometimes direct realism is called naive realism. But yeah, it's this idea that the world is how I perceive it, not just, but through all my senses, how I perceive it. There's no real difference. And of course, the immediate problem that comes up with that, cases like what you're experiencing, a hallucination, that is, you're experiencing, perceiving something that's not actually there, or an illusion, which is perceiving something that's there in a way different than it is. So the proverbial example is like a bent stick, water in water. If you stick a stick in water, it looks bent. It's not bent before you stick it in. It's not bent after you take it out. If you run your hand down it, you feel, but if you look at it through the water, it looks bent. And so for the direct realist, they would have to be committed to saying that the stick is bent and not bent. It just creates a problem for them. And in early modern philosophy, they started to what we refer to as indirect realism or representational realism. And that is, we don't perceive the world as it is. What we perceive is sense data. And what we're really perceiving, in the case of sight, for instance, is the image in our minds or the image that our minds create. So I look out the window. I'm not perceiving the green bush. What I'm perceiving is the image of the green bush in my mind. Does that make sense? You know, the sense data comes through my eye, and here's this image, and that's what I'm perceiving. So what I perceive are images or ideas that represent what's in the world. And so that, it's a little easier to explain illusions and hallucinations in the sense, well, it must be in my mind, or something in my body is not functioning appropriately or whatever, that I'm seeing something that's not there or seeing something different than it is. I mean, there's all kinds of examples of illusions. You can see something in one in one light and it appears to be one color, but you see it in another light and it's another color. So that distinction between direct realism and indirect realism, I think is pretty important when we're talking about perception. And I don't think many people hold to direct realism in a strong sense, because I think we know scientifically that we're perceiving through our senses, and those influence, I guess is what I'm looking for, how we perceive things. So we pretty much know that. So yeah, that's one way to frame it, to start thinking about perception. You know, we don't. And see, the problem with indirect realism, or sometimes referred to as representational realism, now there's this veil between us and the world. We don't perceive the world as it is. What we perceive are the ideas or the images we have of the world. And that, you know, that's the kind of thing that led to skepticism for people like Hume or Bishop Berkeley, who said, you know, to be is to be perceived. Everything's idea. You know, that's where the, if the tree falls in the woods and nobody's there to hear it, doesn't make a noise. It comes from him. And his idea is that existence depends on perception. And if you say, well, what if nobody's there to perceive it? Bishop Berkeley's answer was God perceives everything all the time. And that guarantees, but there's no world out there outside of perception. That's a pretty radical stance, but that's kind of what it leads to, this indirect realism.
Wow. That's a lot to unpack, Chad.
It is.
I think that indirect realism, as you describe it, it makes sense to me. The studies that I've seen about, how our brain fills in information that's not there, or overlooks information that shouldn't be there, that it just kind of blocks that out.
Well, think about if you're looking at a box, this is where you were talking about filling in. You only see two, three sides of the box, but your mind kind of fills in. There's another side there. There's a, you know, a cube, even though you're not perceiving the cube. Be before we move on, I'm curious about, I don't know how much you want to get into this, but how skeptical has your experience of cigarette smoke, of non-existing cigarette smoke, how much has that affected? And you know, when I took philosophy, the first intro class, and I first kind of began to think about our senses are fallible, and that's the main means through which we gain knowledge. And if they're fallible, how can we trust them? I mean, that had a profound effect on me just thinking about it.
Yeah, I think things are slightly mitigated for me because as an older person, some that kind of crisis that you described is one that I went through too, and I think many of us have around how can I trust my sense perceptions. So this is in a more regular and constant way, but I'm just kind of using it as, I guess, a reminder now of the way that you see and experience the world is different from other people. I think that's probably just a true. I mean, I'm not too tied in on needing a commitment from other people to be experiencing the world as I am all the time, which I kind of, I think maybe this is it. It's made me let go of that even more and to just be like, it's really okay that I have a different perception of, let's say, events or common, what should be common experiences, let's say in worship or a movie or a book or something, that I'm getting something different out of it, has been in some ways more affirming to just be like, yeah, my brain and my body are going to perceive things differently because I'm a different person. And that's okay. And maybe I have the perspective that I gain from that is worth sharing. It's unique, but maybe it's not wholly unique to me. Maybe there's somebody else that is experiencing it that same way. It used to matter to me a whole lot more if I were interpreting a passage of scripture for a sermon or for a Bible study or something, that I had like all of these other scholars backing me up. I don't want to be at odds with a whole bunch of them, but if I'm like, oh, I really see this thing that interests me, and I don't find other people talking about it, that used to bother me, and now it doesn't. It's okay to me that I'm having different experiences of things. So that's probably the positive light of it. But on the other hand, I mean, it wasn't just that kind of, for me, it was in kind of late adolescence, that thing of, like, do we really all see the same colors, and are we experiencing the world the same, and having a kind of crisis around that? It's not just that. Like, I feel like I have those crises, something like that, all of the time, and not just with the smoke. I mean, it could be somebody's comments around the way that I look. I'd be like, I don't perceive myself that way. I mean, people who may even, I've gotten, let's say, a check at a restaurant, and they may have identified me as like the redheaded woman or something. And I'll be like, what? I don't have red hair. Then I'll have like a moment of like, wait, what is happening with my hair color, or something. Some guy told me the other week that I look like Kathy Bates. That's not at all how I see myself. And so then, like, that, I let that kind of turn my world upside down. Actually, it still stings. Or times when, I've had a crush on someone, and I thought for sure they liked me back, and boy did they not, and then I'm thinking, wow, I perceived this relationship like a mutual thing that I thought we were both holding together. I perceived that completely differently than they did. And I think everybody's had some kind of experience like that, on at least one side or the other of it. But to go, okay, so is the whole thing like a lie, or messed up, or am I just bad at like social cues and everything else? But those are common experiences, I think, to the human condition.
It's weird. We do perceive things differently, and yet somehow we perceive enough in common that we can function kind of around each other, you know? So how does kind of the general discussion I take here is that our number one, our senses can fail us. Number two, we don't have direct contact with the world. It's mitigated through these senses that can fail us. And this can lead to some skepticism about knowledge and what we can know. How do you think that relates to theology and our knowledge and understanding or experience of God?
I mean, I think we've, at least since Augustine, or heck, wait, Paul. I mean, even the right now we see things through a glass darkly, right? And then we'll see face to face. I mean, there's a kind of idea that these things are both revealed and hidden from us in some way. But thinking about Augustine and him trying to think through language and signs, and how it is that we can even talk about God. And even to, and even when we're just talking about kind of knowledge of God, like the most general, broad theology affirmations that we want to make about the divine, how we struggle sometimes to do that because we have to do it within the confines of human language, which isn't God. It's mediated through something else, right? And through a presupposition that those signs, meaning the words of our language, both mean the same things to the two of us, which sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Or can we really trust that they do? So there's one aspect there of just bringing back how hard that task really is, but how it's a task we won't give up on, particularly when it's your vocation. But that as a community, that we keep trying to talk about it and get as close as we can to describing our experience and our knowledge of God. But then also thinking about our more immediate, or moments where we might have had a more direct sense of the divine, and how we can maybe at all communicate something like that. Because it is such a unique experience, and one that isn't observable to anyone outside of ourselves. I mean, there's no, it's not like the things that I see in a mystical vision also get like projected on the wall behind me. You know, I haven't had one of those, you guys, but I mean that there isn't a way to share that in an immediate way with someone else. It has to be mediated through language or through grasping at metaphors and analogies that can only kind of hint at what those things may be. And that's frustrating because you, even when you have, let's say, a friendly audience, you know, a soul friend or someone who really completely believes that you had that experience, that that part of it's not, there's no skepticism also involved. You know, it's somebody who's really excited and wants to hear about this encounter or this moment of God consciousness that you had, and you can't share it, you know?
I have a I think I'm fairly pragmatic about both the philosophical issue and the theological issue. I mean, just as far as, the separation we have from the world that's mediated through our senses, I think it's true that there's no way that you and I can know if we share exactly the same experience, but somehow we can cooperate and do things. The example we were talking about this the other night, and the example I used is, let's say there's a table with a bunch of different colored cups, and I ask you to hand me the green cup, and you do, and then you turn around, I rearrange them and hand me the green, and you do it every single time. Even if we're seeing different things, we've agreed on green, and it seems to work well enough for us to do stuff. Or just my it, and not just cooperation between people, but I mean, however I'm seeing the world, it seems to work enough for me to function in the world, well enough, I'll put it that way. And I kind of take that same approach with theology, because that's a little starker separation. We really don't know a thing about God's essence, we usually say.
So I'll just God within God's self.
Right, God
That's
within
fair to.
God's self, we don't know a thing about that. It's beyond us. And so it's just a given that whatever we say is going to fall short of the reality to some extent. So why say anything? I mean, again, I kind of take a pragmatic approach. I think we can say enough to about God and gain enough cognitive understanding to go forward in faith and to hold a faith and to live in a faith. I think it's helpful to understand there's limits to those concepts and words and ideas. I think it's healthy to understand that. Otherwise, if I think that God is exactly like my concept of God, that's problematic as far as I can tell. So as long as it works, I mean, that's what I mean by pragmatic. As long as it's working, and when it's not working, then I need to adjust. I mean, I think of my own faith journey, quote unquote, and it's changed over the years, and the way I think about it has changed. And what worked 20 years ago would probably not work for me now. Because I have very clear ideas of what God was like, and that wouldn't sit well with me now, but it's been a journey. So I'm not, skepticism is not real tempting to me, although I understand why people go in that direction, philosophers in particular. It's just, I don't find it convincing, because if you really believed that your senses were untrustworthy completely, you couldn't do a thing. How could you do anything? You wouldn't. But of course, even those who hold very skeptical positions, probably drive their car to work, and they do all kinds of things in which they're obviously trusting the reliability of their senses. But yeah, as far as theology goes, I mean, I feel like I have a pretty healthy idea that we're limited in what we can think and say. So it's not, kind of the apophatic thing we talk about periodically. It doesn't unmoor me to realize that my ideas and concepts and words fall short of the reality. But that might for somebody, I don't know.
I was thinking also in the way that, some folks are hesitant to study things like Revelation or Ezekiel or Daniel because it has so much, quote unquote, weird stuff in it,
Yes.
right? And honestly, you guys, Revelation, if you just read it, it's not nearly as weird as you think it is. But what does trip people up is with some of the apocalyptic or prophetic literature are those images, which are just so outrageous. They're so outrageous that people decide there must be alien spaceships and stuff like that that make more sense to them than a divine revelation. But to remember, that there's a human being involved, whether that's John the Revelator or the prophet, who's being shown these things, who then has to mediate that through human language, right? And there are things unlike anything anyone has ever seen before. The throne room scenes in Revelation are wild, even with all their beauty. But it's got these gemstones and an emerald that looks like a rainbow, and it's like, man, what are you talking about? And then you're like, okay, but that's the closest thing he has to describe this, wheels flying around on fire. I mean, it's just, so what is it? But to be more patient, I think, with that too, and to say, okay, I'm listening. I'm listening. There's something behind that, and it must be just extraordinary. It's beyond human speech. It's not nonsense. It's not nonsense. It's beyond my experience. It's beyond most of our experience. And of course it is, because those prophets and apocalyptics are seeing something given to them in an immediate way, by God, through those images. But then the same goes for, some of the mystical writings, let's say, of Hildegard von Bingen, and and those, the kind of imagery that they're trying to share with us, which we can write off as just outlandish. And some scholars tend to lean on, okay, well, what were they eating? Were they hallucinating because of this substance, or this and that, or maybe she was, suffering a fever and that's where this came from. And I don't know. I think I'm more inclined to take a sympathetic view to all of that now, with, okay, tell me what you saw, and I'm going to listen and see what I can learn there, because I'll trust that your experience is real, at least to you.
And it's communicating something meaningful, presumably, that I can't understand.
Yeah. Yes, because one of the things that all of those people have in common that we hold in the tradition, whether that's a biblical tradition or this later mystical Christian tradition, is that the teachings and that they glean from those visions and those experiences accord with the rule of faith and the law of love, right? So there is definitely something of meaning, of substance to be gleaned there, if we, I think, are willing to listen and to be open to it. And then hopefully maybe that leads to being more and more open to actually having those experiences ourselves. Maybe they're not so far away. It's how closed we
Close-minded we
are.
are.
Yeah.
I like that. I mean, maybe one of the benefits of, this is kind of what I hear you saying, of recognizing the limits of our understanding, especially through perception, but maybe just in general, is it should give us number one, a little more humility. I am not seeing the world as it is. I pretty much assume that. And so I need to take a step back because I could get things wrong. And like again, I'm hearing you say this, and be open to other people's experiences because they might see something I'm not seeing, and so I can learn from them.
Yeah. Yeah.